Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace. This is an Aftershock Monday episode for Monday, January 29th. And this episode, I actually decided to re-release an episode I did in March of last year with Chris Eberle from the Comic Geek Speak podcast. Chris is a big fan of war comics, somewhat of a expert on them, I would say, especially compared to myself. Plus, he's a history teacher, so when I decided to do a spotlight episode on Dreaming Eagles from Aftershock, which deals with World War II and the Tuskegee Airmen, I thought Chris would be a great guest to have on the show to discuss it. So this was before we started doing the Aftershock Monday episodes, so I just wanted to re-release it here for a couple reasons. First of all, there may be some of you that have only started recently listening, especially because we've started these Aftershock Monday episodes, and also because February, which is coming up this week, is Black History Month. So take a listen, and thanks for joining us, everybody. Hope you enjoy it. Talk to you next time. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace. Got a real treat for you tonight. Those of you who are fans of comic book podcasts will probably recognize the voice I'm about to introduce. I have Chris Eberle from Comic Geek Speak joining me tonight. And we're going to talk about a really great comic, and I thought Chris was going to be the perfect one to come on and talk about this comic with me because I know how much he loves war comics. So, Chris, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. That was a too kind of an introduction, but I appreciate it.
So maybe for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with Comic Geek Speak and you in particular, give us a quick intro. How you got into comics, sure. Comic podcasting, what books you enjoy, all that great stuff.
You bet. So I've been infected with the sickness of comics since I was – really since I started – when I first started reading. So, you know, early single-digit age – my parents, when we go on trips, you know, prior to when we could afford air travel, we'd, you know, travel down the shore, down south to Florida and whatnot, and we'd always stop at rest stops and whatnot, or convenience stores, and they'd just buy me random comics. And it sort of began my love affair there, and my father, before I could even read, would read the comics to me and perform the voices, and I was hooked from that moment onward. And as I got older, I started to, you know, realize there was a whole infrastructure to this, you know, back issues and comic shops and flea market stalls and so forth, cartoons, etc. And I began to sort of develop a sensibility as a collector. You know, I started to actually collect certain titles and characters, and I started to appreciate certain creators as well. And I had the bug so bad that in 1999, with the partner, I opened my shop, Wildpig Comics, what has been in business now for 18 years. It's been in different locations, and I can't think of much more that could prove how much I love this hobby that I'm insane enough to have a comic shop.
For sure.
And I mean, granted, with the way things are now, a lot more of it's gaming than anything else, but that's just the nature of the beast. But still a very healthy supply of back issues. It's Wild Pig Comics, wildpigcomics.com. And in terms of the podcast, let's see. Back in 2006, I was looking for other ways to advertise my business, and my good friend Ryan, who's far more internet savvy than I am, discovered CGS, and we started to just do interviews with them, promoting on the store, and just gradually over time, we'd start to develop very close friendships, and I would come on sometimes the show as a guest, you know, for specific episodes, usually dealing with the history of various characters. And then in, let's see, 2013? Yes. One of the cast members took a hiatus, and they asked me to come on as a replacement, and I've been with the show ever since, and it's definitely one of the great joys of my life. I hope to do it as long as they are willing to run the show, and that seems to be the case. So here we are.
A man after my own heart. I don't know if you know this. I had a comic shop, too, briefly, for about three,
I did not.
About 3 years in the 90s. I got out right before the crash hit.
Smart man.
Yeah, I kind of saw the writing on the wall. I was like, yeah, maybe this is not the best thing. So you're also a history teacher.
Yes.
So is that what really drives your love of like historical fiction and war comics?
Yes. The genesis of that is both my grandfathers, one of whom is still living, fought in the Second World War. One fought in Europe, the other fought in North Africa, and so they saw action. One was a prisoner of war, the other fought in the Battle of the Bulge. So growing up, unlike a lot of veterans, they actually talked about their experiences in detail to me from when I was very young. And I was so fascinated by their stories. I wanted to learn about the sort of the background that put them in these, you know, just unbelievable situations. And I started to, you know, actively read about initially World War II, and then I just found a love for history in general, especially military history, branching off from that. And as I got older and started to think about a career, teaching just seemed like the natural fit for me because I have loved history since I was a child. So whenever I find a good military history comic, and I'll talk about when we get into what kind of what made me aware of war comics, I've been a connoisseur ever since. And I'm very excited to talk about Mr. Ennis because I think he's as good as it gets right now when it comes to crafting a good war comic.
That's crazy that you talk. Both my grandfathers also, they're both no longer with us, but they both also, one in Europe and one in the Pacific, in the Philippines, actually.
Oh, wow.
And he's just passed away about a year and a half ago. And he talked about it to me once. That's my mother's father. My father's father never would talk about it ever, but the story, that one day that my mother's father sat down and talked to me about it, it was it really drew me in and gave me a real appreciation for what that generation did and the bravery of those men. So,
did he fight? Is this the grandfather who fought in the Philippines?
In the Philippines, right. The one that fought in Europe, he never didn't want to talk about his military. He was in the military for 30 years.
Oh,
never
wow!
Never wanted to talk about being in the military at all. I think it didn't turn out to be what he thought. He had a kind of rough when he got out, and I think that he always thought it was going to set him up in a certain way, and it didn't. And I think it left him bitter, so he never spoke about it. So for me, what makes a good historical fiction or a historical comic is when it has roots in real events, right? So the setting, it gives you that feel, the tone, and not just of that that time or that particular war, if it's a war comic, but it also, in a way, pulls you back into the sensibility of that time. So if it's pulling you back into the 60s, you can kind of feel the turmoil. If it's pulling you back into the World War II era, you can feel that the togetherness of, you know, we're all pulling in the same direction, trying to fight this axis of evil and things like that. So that's for me, but I am nowhere near the history buff that you are, Chris. So I wonder if you could speak to what makes a good historical fiction or a good historical comic for you personally.
Oh, sure. I mean, I in general share your sensibility in that the war comics that move me the most are ones where the creators have clearly done their homework and everything from the way they depict the equipment and the uniforms through whatever historical backdrop they're utilizing to tell their tale. And I'm going to just hold up so the camera that you can see it. My first real exposure was this book edited by Michael Uslan from 1979 from the Fireside series, America at War. I got this when I was a very little kid, and it's a wonderful – it's not in print anymore, but you can sometimes find it in back issue – like in used trades, but it covers a cross section of DC war comics from the 1940s through the through the 1970s. And got this when I was very young, and I love all the Fireside books, like the Marvel stuff, Origins of Marvel Comics. All these books were a gateway for me as well, and I was completely floored by this. I mean, they had everything from, you know, Superman going to be drafted to these very edgy Sergeant Rock tales to even stories that, from the perspective of members of the Axis. And I just realized, all right, DC's the place to go for war comics. At least that was my experience as a kid. And I started to grab Sergeant Rock comics and back issues. They were still being printed monthly in the early 80s. And I find them at convenience stores and spinner racks and so forth. And like you said, the books that really struck me the most were the ones that either, hey, add a very compelling sort of character-driven piece, even better if it's combined with, you know, a real sense of the history. Now, when I was young, I was still learning, so I didn't fully understand or appreciate all that. But as I got older, especially with like the kind of stuff Innes has been doing. But you need to look back at some of these older stories. You really appreciate the attention to detail. And I think one of the books that struck me the most, both as a kid and now, was the Enemy Ace character, the German fighter pilot from World War One. Because I never – it was the first time I read a comic where it was such an alien perspective as it's from a German, granted from the First World War. And that really struck me. And then when DC did their brief Blitzkrieg series in the 1970s, which I've read a couple of those when I was a kid, that just blew my mind because, like, wow, this is like about Nazis. So it was just interesting that DC was really taking pains to look at different aspects of different wars from different perspectives. And as I got older, I started to think more about like critical thinking and being a teacher and all that. You know, I began to realize how good some of these comics, you know, were and how many of them still hold up. And I think with Innes, I think he's clearly inspired first by a lot of the comics he read in Britain, like Johnny Red and Dan Dare and things like that. And then, you know, he took on a lot of the DC properties too in his own creations as well. And I just think he's the perfect synthesis of that love for the war comic medium just suffused with his clearly detailed knowledge of whatever period he's addressing. So that's kind of like the sweet spot for me.
There's that – if we talk about that same period of time at DC, there's a sense that – it was the more fantastical of the two major publishers. You know, Marvel was considered more the world outside your window.
Right.
DC was maybe a little more on the fantasy side of things. But I find it so interesting that that same publishing house, that same imprint of DC that had these, you know, fantastical fairy tale type superhero tales, had some of the most realistic war comics. And not only in terms of characterization and storytelling, but also in terms of the art. Because you talk about a house style, you know, guys like Russ Heath, Joe Kubert.
Yep.
I mean, this is sophisticated, gorgeous artwork that for the time, yes, often these guys were doing multiple books a month, you know, and now we have creators that can't even do, you know, 10 books a year, you know, nope. An artist. And so when you think about that, I mean, for me, Joe Kubert on Enemy Ace, it gets no better than that. It just is gorgeous.
I concur heartily. And when you mention Kubert, because I think for a lot of people, certainly for me, when you think about like the DC war comics, he's the first artist to think of because he did so many of the covers. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, a lot of the books, he didn't do the interiors, but he did a lot of the covers. And I mean, even this American War, he did the cover for this trade. I mean, he's all over their war comics. And I think he gives a sense of sort of visual continuity to everything. I mean, you know, most of Sergeant Rock titles, you think about how many have his covers, his cover art. And Russ Heath is another magnificent example. So yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think you're right. It's a good point because, you know, the DC superhero stuff in the Silver and Bronze Age, you know, that's a whole other discussion. But, you know, there was a lot of, like you said, fantastical elements.
And very campy.
It could be very well Batman in a zebra suit, for example, and things like that.
Those Legion stories.
Yep, exactly. But then when you get into the war stuff, like you said, I mean, it's a whole other ball of wax. And there's some fantastical elements. It's like, you know, Creature Commandos and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
But it, or like the losers fighting, you know, dinosaurs and what have you, or but so forth. But that's sort of the exception, where a lot of this, even those stories, they're still sort of grounding realistic elements in them. And I think for DC, when I think about DC Comics, one of the things I always think about that affected me the most when I was a kid was their war titles. So,
all right, before we get into the specific book that we're going to talk about, one more point I want to make about war comics and historical comics in particular. Have you? I'm pretty sure that you've read the Archer and Armstrong, that the most recent iteration of Valiant, not the A&A, but when they first launched. Have you read much of that?
I've not read that, actually.
No, okay. Because what I found interesting about that, and I can't believe I cannot remember the writer's name right now. I'm going to look it up real quick. But one of the things that he did that I loved was the fact that he was basing it in history, because for those of our listeners who don't know, the character of Armstrong is immortal. And what he did was he kind of spun it into this whole historical fiction conspiracy thing, where he was taking real events and putting like a kind of a what if kind of a spin on it, where Let's take something like, you know, the big beer flood in, what was it, Amsterdam or something that happened way back when, and being like, oh, look, that was actually Armstrong's fault. And so things like that that I really enjoyed. Let me see if I can find, let's see, 2012 series.
Alternative history is always fun.
Yeah, that's really kind of what it was all about. I can't seem to find it. Anyway. I'll find it and I'll let you know. Let's talk about the book that we really kind of was the impetus for me reaching out to you to talk about, and that is the Dreaming Eagle series put out by kind of a new publisher on the scene, Aftershock Comics, written by Garth Ennis, you mentioned, an incredibly well-known writer, and really, for my money, the best war comics writer out there today. So he's listed as the creator and the writer on the series. The art is by Simon Coleby, C-O-L-E-B-Y, colors by John Kalis, and letters by Rob Steen. So I've always been interested in the Tuskegee Airmen, just as being that they're part of history, knowing that the adversity they faced, not just in fighting a war, in at the beginning of the war, especially having equipment—I mean, and this goes for all pilots at that time—having equipment that was inferior to what the Germans had. But you put on top of that being considered lesser because of the color of their skin, and it always fascinated me. You know, everybody loves an underdog, let's say. So when the series came out, I was like, "Well, it's Tuskegee Airmen, basically. It's Garth Ennis. Yeah, I'm in." And when the series started, it was not really what I expected. I expected it to be more of an adventure story. And it really turns out to be more of a character piece. And yes, the story is secondary. But it floored me. It was so, like, I was expecting an adventure, fun, war comic, you know, shoot 'em up, biplanes, dogfighting. Or not biplanes, but, you know, World War II era planes, dogfighting. And it turned out to be so much more than that. And it really blew me away. What did you think when you – well, did you know about it like right when it got announced? Did you know when the first issue was coming out? Did you know right away you were going to read it? What was your introduction?
Yeah, I mean, basically this is the way it works with Ennis and me. So every time I see his name in previews, I just order it. It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, if it's a war comic, I'm even more gung-ho for it because I've loved his work since I was exposed to Preacher, which was the first time I read Ennis. Even though he'd done work before that, like on Demon and Hellblazer. And then once I read Preacher, I kind of tried to grab everything I could because, you know, his sense of humor is very much in keeping with what I appreciate, his sense of satire, and also the sense that a lot of his stories, when you get past some of the ultra-violence and the dark humor, there's often a very strong moral center in a lot of his stories. And a lot of them, I think, really deal with loyalty and friendship and relationships and things of that nature. I think you really get that in this book. So as soon as I saw he was doing another war comic, because Ennis has been churning out a lot of war comics in recent years.
Yeah, a lot with Avatar.
With Avatar, now with Aftershock. So he's been doing a lot of work. I mean, the first time I read his war comic, to get too sidetracked, was when he did some war stories for DC Vertigo several years ago, which I think are now available through Avatar, if I remember correctly. And he's been on a roll ever since. I was deeply excited when I read the solicitation for this because my favorite war comic of all time is Garth Ennis's Enemy Ace, War in Heaven, which I consider a masterpiece. And I think Russ Heath one of the artists on that? I want to say he was.
Did the art, I believe, in the second.
Yeah, he did one of the issues. That's right. Yeah, yeah. So
actually, that was signed by Russ last September at a long show in Long Beach, California.
You lucky SOB.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
That story, I think, was a perfect synthesis of what we've been talking about, like, you know, the sort of the great history of DC war comics, but infused with Ennis's just eye for detail and historical backdrop and also character. And so when I got this, like you, I thought, all right, it's probably going to have amazing recreations of combat. But I wasn't sure what the story was going to address otherwise. I knew he'd go into the significance of Tuskegee Airmen, but what I found such a pleasing surprise, and you were referencing this before, was how character-driven this was. And Ennis is so clearly – I mean, he's an Irishman. I believe he lives in New York now, if I remember correctly. he's so clearly invested in the history of America. And I love how he took this notion of Tuskegee Airmen, and yes, he gave us the historical context from when they were operating, but he also then brings that into the turmoil of the civil rights era of the 1960s. And so you get that connection, and also you get – it's also a tale about a father and a son and their disconnect and how the experience of the father and the son on sort of on different periods of that struggle for equality, how they come together over this father's experience in the war. And just like the classic motif of like father and son sitting on the porch knocking back a beer and the father sort of, you know, revealing himself in terms of his history. I think sometimes people underestimate what a great writer Innes is. They think of things like Preacher and how over the top that material can be. This is a far more subtle story, and some of the most powerful scenes of this book is not the fighting. It's the father and the son sharing, you know, that experience. I think for me, this is one of the best military comics he's done in his career. So that's like my initial thoughts on it. But
yeah, I completely agree. And I don't want – I mean, you and I clearly both love Garth Ennis and this comic in particular. And we could sit here and we could go issue by issue and dissect it and talk about what we love about it. But I want to save that for you listeners. I want you to go out and pick this up. Mm. It's out in trade. I want you to enjoy it for yourself. So we're not going to go issue by issue and talk about, you know – how the whole story plays out. I want you to enjoy that and experience that for yourself. We will talk about a few favorite moments, but I do just kind of want to give you the general sense of the story, and then I'm going to let Chris talk a little bit, use some of his historical expertise to give a little more background on who the Tuskegee Airmen are. So as Chris and I both mentioned, the actual story is set in 1966. It's an urban setting. I don't know that they necessarily say where, but it's an urban setting. It's 1966. It's a time of turmoil in America. It's that fight for civil rights. And as Chris said, what Innes does is he places these layers. So this is how the story opens. So maybe I'll say this is the top layer. It's the civil rights. It's the unrest. It's the war that these minorities were fighting at this time. And then below that, you have the layer of the father starting to open up to the son and their relationship, because they have – you can see that there's love there, that they care for each other. But when the story starts out, it seems like they've never been able to see eye to eye. They've never been able to really communicate. The emotion is there, and they clearly care for each other, but they've never been able to speak the same language. And then finally, the last layer, the bottom layer, is the layer that, you know, drew me in the first place, and that's the setting of World War II. And these men who were minorities and wanted to be something more than just, you know, a cook on a battleship or swabbing decks, you know, and they were intelligent, and some of them were educated, but they still were seen as lesser just because of the color of their skin. So those are kind of the three layers to the story, and as the story unfolds, we see, as Chris mentioned, the father and son kind of communicating and connecting for the first time through the father relating the story and the struggle that he had as a member of the Tuskegee Airmen, and the son kind of realizing and having his eyes open for the first time about what a great man his father is and how he should respect. And his father isn't afraid. His father has just seen war, whether it be a civil rights war or a literal war. He's seen that and he understands the horror. And that's why he feels the way he feels about the civil rights movement. And he, you know, every father wants their children to be safe. And so you can completely understand the father's reluctance to see his son be on the front lines of this civil war. So that's kind of the overall story and plot. And like I said, I don't want to get too much into detail because I want you to enjoy it for yourself. But I feel like with these layers and the story structure that Innes used, because he flips back and forth constantly throughout the story, and I feel like it was a very effective a way to continually remind you as a reader of the parallels of these two times and how they both really are a war in a way for one's soul. for the soul of America and the soul of man. Did you feel that as well, Chris?
Absolutely. I echo your sentiments completely. What I found so moving about this was Innes never lets the reader forget that narrative thread. It takes you through the entire story, and I agree with you. I don't want to spoil too much, but I mean, at the end, when they're sort of finishing out their conversation, and you know, the father makes an admission about how he feels about what he went through, you know, during the World War II, and then how he feels now about being back at his homeland. I nearly wept. Because you realize how all this man went through, and he still doesn't feel fully appreciated or at home in his homeland. And then, you know, the connection where he's also acknowledging at the end how the son's going to kind of continue now that struggle in his own way to help them feel more at home in their homeland. And Innes expertly reminds you of that struggle and the different forms it takes, the different iterations through various eras in American history. So that's, for me, that's the most moving part of this book is that father-son relationship and that the, sort of the closing out of their conversation on the porch and then subsequently at the dinner table. And just those few scenes, you realize what the father really went through and how, you know, the historical – I mean, the father is a fictitious character, but he represents, you know, people who went through experiences like that. And you think about what those men had to endure. Because as you say, you made a great point. These are not like grunts. Pilots are expert technicians. You got to be really flippin' smart to be a fighter pilot. I mean, this is not, you know, like you said, some guy, you know, swabbing a deck. Not that I'm putting that down either. That's his own type of hard work. But, you know, these people have to be highly intelligent and technically proficient. And like you said, they were still treated like, you know, they were the help. And these were pilots. So this was an elite within an elite. And Innes also takes pains. And this is for the narrative of the story, because the father's narrating the whole thing. And he really goes into, and this you can tell Innes did his homework, like once again, you know, what they had to go through, their training and the political situation that was, you know, affecting everything they were doing or limiting what they were doing. You know, the types of planes they were using, the ones that were of better quality, like the P-51, which they finally got was one of the best fighters of the war. And just the frustrations of dealing with, you know, sort of the white power structure and so forth. And he really suffuses the whole book with that. Not though – and what's this, again, mark of a great writer for me. Not in an in-your-face sort of clumsy, preachy way. It's all part of the narrative. As a father, we never forget this is a father bonding with his son and telling him this story, probably like, you know, your grandfather told you about that the Philippines is that his, that one day, and the many times I've had the force of talking to my grandfathers about their experiences, which were horrific. And I can only imagine what your grandfather saw in the Philippines. That was a barbaric campaign.
Oh yeah.
So this is as good as it gets, folks, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to you know, a top flight military history comic.
Yeah, and you know, I completely agree. The father-son dynamic is what really drives this, because you can see, as you know, it's six issues long, but the trade is out. You can get in trade, but you can see as the issues unfold, or as you read the story in whole in the trade, you can really see the father and son's relationship start to change. You can see it start to grow. You can see it start to blossom. And in a way, as I was talking about, they always seem to have trouble communicating. There seemed to be a wall there. And not a wall of distrust or hate or anything like that, because they clearly cared about each other, but just a barrier in their way they communicated. And you can see as the story unfolds, it's like Innes is taking that wall down brick by brick, and it's just it's very, very moving, as Chris said. And so I'm going to let you talk a little bit, give us a little brief lesson on the Tuskegee Airmen, Chris, but real quick, just one comment on something you said about them having to be technicians and everything, and the horror of war and everything they had to put up with. And that's enough, right? That's enough to put on a man. And you put on top of that the politics, you know, like you mentioned, and them loving their country so much and wanting, you know, and volunteering and wanting to risk their life. And then on top of that, wanting to push the barrier and wanting to do more than just swab a deck, wanting to do more than just cook. I marvel at their bravery. I really do. So I wonder if you could just give us a brief history about the Tuskegee Airmen and what these men were really all about.
Sure. I mean, I'm not an expert, but I still give you the basics. And Innes himself does a lot of this really in the story.
Right,
so as you go through the story, but again, it's not in a like a didactic way. It's just as you're reading the story, it comes out what were the Tuskegee Airmen about. But there were some people within the United States government and the military and civilian life, people like Eleanor Roosevelt, for example, who were enlightened, who wanted to sort of, you know, nudge things along when it came to the place of African Americans in American society. And I'm sure many listeners know, slavery was abolished in the 13th Amendment, but you had segregation imposed in the South starting at the end of the 19th century by law. It was often, you know, by choice or economics in the North. And you know, whites and blacks, there was often – they lived in different worlds. There might be some interaction in terms of work and things of that nature. But, you know, in many states like Virginia, it was illegal for a black person, a white person to get married until the Loving ruling of the 1960s. So, you know, this is a very polarized society when it came to racial dynamics. And that was always the case in the military. I mean, I'm sure many people have seen the Civil War movie Glory, for example, which is a great film, you know. African Americans have been struggling for recognition and equality in the military. I mean, going back even before the Civil War to the American Revolution. So you take that tradition forward through all these conflicts. I mean, I'm sure many of us have heard of the Buffalo Soldiers, the classic Bob Marley song. These are some of the crack regiments of the United States Army in the post-Civil War up to Spanish-American War. And these are the men who ironically were often used to the best effect to fight the Indians of the Plains, you know, one sort of oppressed minority against another. In fact, the Buffalo Soldiers sort of helped Theodore Roosevelt in his storied charge up San Juan and Kettle Hills. They just never get any credit for it. So that's a running theme. You know, you have these highly proficient, dedicated professionals who are African Americans through American military history who often, you know, get the short end of the stick. And then you come to the Tuskegee Airmen, whereas America enters full throttle, no pun intended, you know, the total war that was the Second World War. And you have a small but persistent movement to get some of these men into fighter craft. And as you mentioned, you know, that they train them in the Tuskegee airfield in Alabama. And all the training the white pilot went through, but of course, on top of that, if you do a parallel with like Jackie Robinson when he was playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers, they couldn't make any mistakes. Imagine you're in a situation where you have to conduct yourself at such a higher level than everyone else around you just to be accepted on sort of that lower level of everybody else. And whether it was the training, you know, they couldn't make mistakes because any kind of mistake they made, their enemies in the political scene would make a fuss in Congress, for example, and try to delegitimize and defund what they were doing. They had to absorb every kind of taunt and insult from, you know, their fellow white airmen and so forth. And they just had to take it. And one of the key characters in the book that is an historical figure is Benjamin O. Davis, who was the commander of these all-black fighter squadrons. And the book, Innes does a good job of going into it. He really wasn't known for being a pilot. He could fly, but he was known for, you know, persistently, with tremendous fortitude, you know, in the political arena, constantly lobbying to get his men the best equipment, to get them the recognition, to get them the right missions, to show that they were as capable as any white pilot. And this guy had to just swallow loads and loads, you know, of just guff to deal with this. And it's something that most people couldn't do it. You couldn't handle the constant – just the browbeating and just even all the little indignities that pile up and accumulate, just wear you down. And, you know, the story really, really touches upon that throughout, about just what they had to deal with, whether it was how they were trained or what, how they were shortchanged, you know, the, like the last people to get the proper planes, not always getting the best missions, and of course the political movement. I love the character, Jace, the character of the Southern congressman.
Oh, yeah.
who he kind of represents, you know, the typical view of like, you know, black people should be, quote, in their place, so to speak, and only, you know, should be doing certain things, and how he's trying to undermine them. And I won't ruin, there's a wonderful scene, though, about midway through the story where there's another officer, there's an officer who's escorting him who's a northerner, and they kind of get into this debate about sort of the meaning of the Civil War, and you can tell which side Ennis is on by the end of that conversation. It's very cutting and very well done. But that scene also reminds you of how America, ever since the Declaration, is sort of this ongoing experiment. We're always trying to live up to the sort of the blueprint Jefferson and his words laid out, which, I mean, he didn't even fully intend himself being a slave owner. But – and this, the story of the Tuskegee Airmen is just another chapter in that ongoing attempt to sort of reach this more perfect union that, you know, Lincoln was always talking about during the run-up to and during the Civil War. So the Tuskegee Airmen are part of that process. And as the book points out, they became, by war's end, a highly proficient – and there were different – we kind of use the term Tuskegee Airmen collectively. There were different squadrons. But this highly proficient group of pilots, and they, you know, the tails of their planes were painted red. So like the George Lucas did the movie Red Tails. That is not the best movie about the Tuskegee Airmen. The best movie I saw, it was on HBO. I think it's just called The Tuskegee Airmen.
Yep.
Amazing actors. Lawrence Fishburne, Andre Brower, Cuba Gooding Jr. You know the movie I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, I've seen both. Yeah. And yeah, I had high expectations, high hopes for Red Tails because I enjoyed that that – I think it came out in the mid-90s, that HBO film. And yeah, Red Tails was just kind of like, meh.
Red Tails, it's worth watching. It's right. Like a solid like adventure film, basically. Yeah. And they go into some more talking about the, but the Tuskegee Airmen, that first movie, it's got just better acting, number one.
Right.
But number two, it really goes into I think with more meat into what we're talking about here.
Right. Yeah.
And they do a lot more with Davis, for example, and so forth in that. So by war's end, and the book goes into this. And Innes, by the way, he does this with a lot of his war comics. He has a wonderful afterword where he goes into some of the history and he provides some additional context. But by war's end, these units were renowned for escorting the B-17s over those extremely dangerous missions over occupied Europe and especially Nazi Germany itself. And – you know, they were renowned for losing very few bombers in comparison to – or in contrast to other fighter escorts. So
– yeah, the other pilots were requesting them with great frequency. And yeah. I don't know. Maybe you know this, Chris. I don't know necessarily, but I feel like there had to be a level of acceptance. There had to be a greater level of acceptance throughout the military by the end of these pilots just because of the proficiency. I have to think it got a little easier for them. I mean, certainly never easy, but it must have been a little easier because they had proved themselves, you know, trial by fire, so to speak.
I would like to think so. I mean, I'm making an educated guess here. I think part of it is, and they even mentioned this in the story at some point, I don't remember where exactly, but if your life is on the line, you don't give a damn if the guy's, you know, black, brown, or purple.
Right.
And I mean, those bomber missions, it's hard for us to understand. I'm just going based on what I read, but they were so dangerous.
Yeah.
If those things got hit the wrong way, you went down in a flaming coffin.
Yep.
Essentially. And you relied on those escorts for your life. Mm-hmm. Cause those bombers were difficult to defend. I mean, they had machine guns on them, you know, in the various turrets and so forth. But
yeah, when they're weighed down with all that ordnance, you're not maneuvering around, you know.
No. And then the German – the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, is one of the finest air forces in the history of air forces. and their pilots were of a very high caliber, especially in the early years of the war before they lost a lot of men. But and the Germans, as we mentioned, had overall some of the best military technology of the Second World War. Their problem was they didn't have enough in quantity compared to the Allies. But their aircraft were of a very high caliber, so until we finally caught up with the P-51, for example. So you needed top flight pilots. And the book also notes that these guys were so good that, you know, even in cases where the Germans had better aircraft, their skills were off. Their skills sometimes could close that gap, even though – what was the P-40 they were flying earlier on, want to say?
Yep.
Yeah, which was not – which was overall not as capable a plane in some ways as the Messerschmitt 109 or the Focke-Wulf. But sometimes experience and skill can in some cases close that gap, and they emphasize that in the story as well. These were outstanding fighter pilots who, again, endured, like you said, even more adversity than a white airman would have experienced because of the racial dynamic. So,
yeah, and
extraordinary.
In no way do Chris and I want to lessen what any Caucasian pilot had to put up with. Please,
well, of course
don't
not.
Think that at all. But it's just what the adversity these men faced was just. In my mind, it takes a very brave man. So let's talk a little bit about favorite moments. I have three in the book.
Sure.
That I'll talk about. Well, I'll just go in chronological order, actually. Issue 3, page 9. The father and son have been talking for a while. You get the impression they've been talking for a while. And the son stands up and says, I have to use the restroom. And the father says, I was just about to tell you about my first kill. What does the son say? I can hold it. I just love
right.
that. I mean, it's just one of those little moments that Ennis puts in that makes the characters, seem real.
Yep.
My next favorite moment is from issue 4, page 1. Let me get there here. And it's where the father and the son, and you mentioned this earlier, we've seen it in stories before, Chris, where it's the father and the son bonding over a beer, and the son is not old enough to drink. Let me put that out there, and that's made known by Ennis. And it's another simple moment where you can see that wall's coming down. It's page one. They both pop the tops on another beer, and they clink it, and the story continues. And just again, a great character moment that really. Kind of helps set the mood, it sets the tone, it helps set the emotion, and it's not something that I see a lot of new writers do or do well, but for a veteran writer like Ennis, putting these little moments in there that helps to kind of set the stage, and I just appreciate it. And the last moment has to do with that that congressman that you were mentioning, talking to one of the other, actually, I think he's military intelligence, and they're talking about the difference. And it's clear that this congressman, the Southern congressman, thinks of himself as a Southern gentleman, thinks of himself as sophisticated and educated. But it's clear that this quote unquote Yankee in the military intelligence is so far above. In terms of intelligence and in terms of realizing what the future holds. And he kind of talks circles around him, but doesn't make it overt. And it kind of gets the congressman's goat. And the congressman raises his finger. He says, "Ayada." And the military intelligence officer says, "Rise again." And I laughed out loud. It was so perfect. The South will rise again. It was so perfect. So those would probably be my three favorite moments. How about you, Chris?
The one you just described is definitely one of mine. Let's face it, the North-South dynamic is one of the key sort of fault lines in our history. For all sorts of reasons, and Ennis kind of personifies it in these two sort of archetypical characters,
right?
And he you know where he falls on that line, essentially, as he's, you know, it's clearly his perspective, and I enjoy that thoroughly. And I want to jump back on something, piggyback on something you said I thought was very well put, is that one of the reasons why Ennis is such a great writer, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, is that he often will find great character moments in having people or friends would have you sit down over a beer or in a bar. You see that kind of motif many times in his stories. It always works because it's in those quiet moments where you really see the subtlety and the skill of a writer. And that definitely comes through. I mean, that's what's the narrative thread of this whole book, which is the father and the son. So, yeah, definitely the southern and the northern speaking.
There's, to speak to that, there's not any action to distract you from poor writing or poor plotting, because it is quiet moments. It is what's happening in the story and in the panel is so simple.
The other scene for me was, as I mentioned earlier, without spoiling too much, was just when the father and the son sort of come to terms with where they are in terms of the struggle, and how the father really opens up to how, you know, he feels about what the war meant and where his place is in the America of today, back then in the 1960s, and how he's still struggling with what he experienced and its meaning in this new era. And then also just when at the end of the story, and again, I won't give away too much, but, you know, the father and the son clearly come to terms with how each one's sort of place in the sort of ongoing struggle, and that's over the dinner table. It's also extremely well done and very personal. And otherwise for me, and this is for me in all the Ennis books, his attention to technical detail is so breathtaking. I mean, you know, once again, this man has done so much research on these planes, and through the father explaining, like, you know, dogfighting techniques, and, you know, it's again, it's a level of research you often don't see in any kind of medium, for that matter. And as a student of all this throughout much of my life, I mean, that it always thrills me to see that so well done. And you always get the sense out of any war comic Ennis does that's World War II based, there's always this. Obviously not for their cause, but there's always this respect for the German warrior and how really they were in a class by themselves, just strictly as warriors and the technology they applied. And a lot of his stories really get into how daunting it was to try to defeat that sort of – that warrior – high-tech culture that the Nazis at the time represented.
Right. Yeah, that definitely comes through. It's that old adage where I can hate what you do. You know, I can hate your actions. I can hate what you stand for. It doesn't mean I hate you as a person. It's that same thing. They, you know, their technical proficiency, their bravery, you know, I might not have agreed with what they believed in, but I, you know, they're human and they have the right to fight for what they believed in. And that always, there's always that respect. Yeah. As you said, let's talk a little bit.
Okay. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, if you're done, let's switch over and talk a little bit about the art. But if you have any.
Sure.
So I don't think that this book would work anywhere near as well as it does, being that it's a war comic based on pilots and based on air combat, without the art of Simon Colby.
It's breathtaking.
It is so good. And the thing that struck me right from the first issue, I can sum it up in one word, and that's the angles. The angles he takes, or the perspective he takes in the panels, that, because when you think about it, air combat is so different from ground combat in that it really is, you know, it's not just to your left, to your right, it's below you, it's above you, it's you know, completely around you in every degree, every angle. And Ennis talks about it when he talks about the dogfighting and, you know, being able, what you could see, your you know, your field of vision in certain planes. And Simon Colby's art, without effort, it seems like, He puts that across on the page. It shows through so clearly, and I could almost smell the cordite.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. Again, like Ennis, he clearly did his homework. The detail on the planes is amazing. And I should mention, I forgot this. He also drew Royals Masters of War. Did you read that?
I did not. Not familiar.
Okay,
with that.
That's a more recent Vertigo series. I think it's Vertigo. You love it. It's an alternate history series about the royal family during, you know, the Second World War, and they have superpowers.
Oh, sounds interesting.
And the politics behind it, how they're not supposed to use their powers. It's in trade. Check it out. But his art is featured in that as well. So you get him also doing World War II era art, but with a more fantastical context. This is the first time I've seen his work. I wasn't familiar with his work before this. I mean, I heard his name, but it's breathtaking. And again, to me, one of the most exciting planes of World War II is the Messerschmitt 262 jet fighter. And boy, does he do that justice. And Innes goes into all that in the back, too, about the different planes and in his aftermath. But
now I've seen this.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I've seen in the past, because I actually, when I was a kid, I used to want to be a fighter pilot. So I used to, any comic that had, you know, jet planes or World War II era planes, I always gravitated to them. And I always noticed that sometimes the artist would be good at one aspect, one, you know, like they could do great detail on one plane. But if that particular artist tried to draw multiple planes or the panels or the double page spreads where it's that whole field of vision, you know, we've all seen the newsreels where, you know, it's a whole fleet of bombers and their fighter escorts.
Right.
And they could do that well, or they could do one plane or two planes well. But oftentimes, if they were good at one, they weren't good at the other. The perspective looked off. It blew me away, some of these double page spreads where it you really felt like you were there. It just looked so realistic to me. And I was completely blown away by his technical proficiency. But then at the same time, such a great sense of storytelling, especially when it comes to facial expressions and emotion.
Couldn't agree more. Well, the scene early on when I think it's a German pilot is bailing out and his chute has broken. Watch him plummeting to the earth. Part of his arm is already mangled. It's terrifying. Or, you know, there's a scene where this is one of the most horrifying scenes in the whole book. It's a double page spread of the B-17 going down. The one pilot is headless. The other is injured and trying to keep the plane level. You really get a sense, as much as a comic can, of just how just dangerous this whole aspect of the war was, and how there was so little margin for error, and if, you know, a lot of it's just luck also, and if like you said, these things are so loaded down with ordnance that if the flak hits the wrong place, or if you're in the gun sights of a fighter, you're in deep trouble. And they also make the point of talking about how, and I can only imagine the horror of this, you'd send people on the radio would hear the crew going down and they couldn't get out. So, you know, this is not a video game.
No, definitely
this is,
not.
You know, this is flesh and blood, and it's very fragile flesh and blood. You know, think about it in a way how insane it all is, you know, in these huge metal constructs. Terrifying.
Yeah, I give Simon Colby all the credit, because, you know, it's often that you see artists who are good, who really study human facial expression, and they can really convey that emotion across the page. You know, they're very much masters of their craft. Now take away half the face and think about how much more of a challenge that is, because a lot of times these fighter pilots, you know, the bottom of their face is covered by their air mask, by their breathing mask.
Yep.
So you're just getting eyes and eyebrows, and yet you can sense the fear or sense the triumph after a fighter gets a kill. It's just incredibly, incredibly well done. And I feel like the colors as well by John Kalis, who is a colorist I'm familiar with, does a lot of work for DC, sets the tone so well. You really get a sense of history. You know, you're reading about the past. It's a little bit of a muted palette. But the combat scenes, you know, I say muted palette, but the combat scenes with these explosions, where, again, there are times I felt like I could feel the heat of these fires. I could smell the smoke. I could smell the cordite. Just incredibly well done. And you take all those things together. You take those angles. You take the layouts, the facial expression, the emotion, the colors, and it really sets a mood overall for the book. And so I really can't say enough about what an incredible job this creative team did. And I really hope you all go out and pick it up. Any final thoughts about this particular six issue story, Chris?
Only that I would say, just kind of as a closing comment about Ennis's work here, is that yes, definitely get this book if you enjoy it. A lot of his war comics are in trade now. His Battlefield stories, I think, I want to say from Dynamite Entertainment. I think you mentioned his work from Avatar, some of the older DC stuff. It's all. I think this is one of the best things he's done in terms of military comics. But there's a strong. He clearly loves this world. And he clearly feels – I get a sense he feels an obligation to get it right when he's telling these stories. And it really shines through, I think, in this book especially. But all his military history work is highly recommended. So
yeah, now I just want to talk a little bit about Aftershock as a publisher. Are there any other of their books that you're actively reading? I mean I know as a retailer you're familiar with them.
Yeah, actually, not yet, but I have a couple trades I got that I just haven't had a chance. I have not as bad as Murd, but I have like a growing pile of books I got to work through. But,
we all do.
Yeah, I picked up their trade, the first arc of that book where the animals start all become sentient.
Animosity, very good.
Animosity, yeah. I haven't read that yet. And then also the one about the Rough Riders?
Yes.
Theodore Roosevelt?
Right, yep, yep.
So those two are on my nightstand. I haven't read them yet.
Yeah, that actually, volume two of that one, Rough Riders of the Storm, actually, I think is the title of volume two is supposed to start. That's my co-host Manny. That's one of his favorite Aftershock titles. I'll just say that, you know, I know that Chris and any of our listeners who also listen to CGS know what a big fan you are of Image Comics, because they give the creators the freedom to tell any type of story they want. Aftershock, very similar. I would say very similar. If there's any difference, it's that Aftershock goes a little bit farther in support of the creators, in that they with Image, a lot of times you have to kind of do your own promotion and some of the administrative aspects. Aftershock does a lot of that for the writers, and then obviously they're going to take, you know, compensation for that. So it's a little bit different model. But if you look at some of the names of these creators who've chosen to tell these stories from Aftershock,
they've got some big names.
Yeah, you know their quality, and Joe Pruitt and Mike Martz and the guys over there on the executive side are top notch. They're all veterans of the industry, so I encourage you to go out there and there's plenty of Aftershock titles out there on the stands. You know, just take a look at the covers, read a few solicitations. I'm sure there's something out there that's gonna tickle your fancy. So first, I want to thank Chris for joining me. Real pleasure. Love to have you on again.
Love to, sir. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me. And I'd like to thank all you listeners for joining us as well. Please visit us at thecomicsourceblog.com for all past episodes of the podcast. You can also watch episodes of our YouTube channel there, as well as finding links to Manny's written blog and my written blog, and of course, our famous sketch gallery. Be sure you're following us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Also do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to keep up to date on new episodes and all our convention coverage. Manny and I will both be at WonderCon in Anaheim, California this weekend. So in Instagram, you're going to see a lot of pictures on there. And of course, I'll have interviews with creators that I do on site. Don't forget about our exclusive podcast in partnership with LRM, the 9-panel grid. You can go to LRM online to enjoy new episodes every Tuesday covering a variety of topics. So once again, thanks for joining me, Chris, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
Thank you.